If you're holding ETH, you want to watch this video because it's not looking very good. Even though Bitcoin's moving sideways, if you look at the ETH BTC chart, we've now hit the cycle lows, and everyone that I speak to is talking very negatively about ETH. I think today we have to dig into the future of ETH, and I think we have to call a spade a spade. We can't just keep pretending that everything's going to be okay while this chart just basically goes down and down and down. What we need to find out today is whether if you have money in ETH, whether you should be taking your money and putting it elsewhere. And if it is, then where should you be putting your money? Today is not really about Bitcoin. It's all about ETH and the future of ETH. So let's go. I love ETH. ETH was the first mainstream smart contract blockchain. I was in ETH since $6 or something like that, or $9. I don't remember the exact number. And I've held my ETH all the way up to here. But I mean, it's getting to a point now where holding ETH is very, 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 very difficult. Like, it is the second biggest crypto asset. There has been an ETF. And despite that, it just keeps bleeding and bleeding and bleeding, not only against Bitcoin, but actually against the US dollar as well. That's the ETH USDT chart. So I guess let's just call a spade and find out whether it's worth holding our ETH or not worth holding our ETH. That's what we're going to be talking about today. Also, got a very special guest for you. He's going to be telling you how he would allocate $10,000 if he was investing $10,000 today, which layer ones, etc., etc. And he's also going to tell you when the sideways choppy action is going to end. So it's going to be a big show today. We've got Suzu on with us. Also, I mean, what you'll see is that after this event today, the front runners are actually going to meet and talk to Suzu in the front runners Discord. So if you're not already a member of the front runners Discord, just go to front runners here, sign up. When the waiting list opens, you will be allowed in. But again, one of the benefits to our members is that when we do these banters, like with Raoul Paul and Suzu and all the big guests, you actually get to interact with them after the show. And a lot of the front runners are actually watching the show in the back end. So they're actually in the back end watching the show. So remember, this is a Friday banter. Our Friday banters are brought to you by NordVPN. I don't really think I have to say very much about NordVPN, especially after this week. I don't know if you remember, but Pavel Durov, who's the founder of Telegram, was arrested in France. And the reason why he was arrested is effectively because he won't comply with the demands of the EU and the French government. And the demands are all about censorship around transparency on a messenger that he's built, which is around privacy, right? Now, what you can see is that there's 12 charges, but the number two charge is the refusal to communicate at the request of competent authorities information or documents necessary for carrying out and operating interceptions allowed by law. What does that mean? It effectively means he is not willing to give your information away to them. And as a result, he may sit in prison and they may actually even shut down the Telegram app. Who knows? What this also shows you is that every other app that you use is actually giving away your details. Now, the way that they give away your details is very simple. They say, we want all users in Europe, all users in the United States, because obviously the United States government can't ask for people in South Africa, right? And how they determine, if they don't have your details on file, like Telegram, how they determine where you're at is by using your IP address. So every time you use a computer, you are sending your IP address to the user. So I'll show you, this is NordVPN. And you'll see that it'll say, status, this is who I am. It knows exactly where I am. It tells him it's in South Africa. And now, bang, I've fallen into that net. You can change this. You change this by buying a VPN. If you want to buy a VPN, just click on this link here and buy NordVPN. If you do, you'll pay $3.99 a month or less than $3.99 a month. You'll get 30-day money-back guarantee, 4 months extra, etc., etc. But most importantly, you will get a VPN which allows you, look at this, a VPN basically allows you to fib about where you are. So I can pretend that I'm in the Arab Emirates. Watch this. Bang. Now the server thinks I'm actually in the United Arab Emirates. I know it sounds crazy, but that's what it actually thinks. So if I go back and what I can do with NordVPN, which is unique to NordVPN, is I can actually do a double VPN. So I can click that. And then I can have a VPN on top of a VPN, which means that they will never, ever, ever, ever know who I am, where I'm from. And that way, governments, hackers won't know where we're at. So I keep saying to you guys, stop delaying this, because every day that you're surfing without a VPN in crypto, it's getting worse and worse. Do it today. Take 2 seconds. Go and spend $2 and take your crypto seriously this month. All right, now, with that in mind, listen, I know it's been a treacherous, a choppy sideways action. And I know a lot of people are suffering from the choppy sideways action. I do want to chat to my good friend Sue. He's a renowned investor. The guy is one of the smartest guys in crypto today. And I think let's see how he's feeling about the cycle and how bullish he is. Sue, how are you, my friend?
Good, how are you?
Good. How are you feeling about the markets? Like, we've been going sideways for like 184 days. I mean, it feels like this chop's never, ever, ever going to end. How are you feeling? Are you still confident that this thing's going to move up soon?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think actually it's pretty bullish, right? You've seen a lot of random flows. You've seen German selling, you've seen Gox selling, you've seen all sorts of stuff. And I think, you know, all things considered, Bitcoin's holding pretty well. I think people are actually more upset because of Bitcoin dominance being high and being, you know, I think Ether has kind of really been that real bear market vibes kind of feel. I think Bitcoin itself, I don't think even within Bitcoin, the vibes are that bad, right? We're at 60K, 61K right now. The chart looks fine, in my opinion. You know, chop is tough because I think there was those two big events. I think one was the Trump rally where everyone's like, we're going to break out to 100K because Trump's going to mention Bitcoin strategic reserve. And then it went like to 50K like 2 days after. But other than that, I don't think it was particularly brutal on Bitcoin itself. I think like really the ETH capitulation on the ETF, that was like the pain story of the summer. So
let's talk about like the ETH capitulation on the ETF. What do you like? I look at the ETH BTC chart. Let me just quickly get it for us. So there's the ETH BTC chart. I mean, this chart looks this looks like a bad chart. The last time we had you on the show, you were quite bullish on ETH. Like, where's your view now around ETH? Are you still as bullish on ETH? Like, I called the bottom over here. I mean, it looks like my call's getting challenged here. What, like, how do you feel about ETH BTC? A lot of people are pronouncing it dead. I listened to Kyle Samani. Kyle Samani is naturally a Solana bull. So how are you feeling about ETH?
I think fundamentally it's getting a bit worse than last time we spoke. I mean, I think that it did have that, you know, on the ETF announcement, it did that big pop. And that was kind of, I think last time we spoke, it was before that announcement. But I think the problem is that like the market front ran it so hard, I think, that this idea of there would be institutional inflows. And I think that, you know, ETH is an asset which is very easy for the market to get leveraged long on because there's so many ways to do it in DeFi and there's so many ways to do it on perps and everything. So I think, you know, to the extent that people can get bullish on ETH during this cycle, I think now is one of the best times because you have a lot of capitulation that has come through and you have like, you know, Bitfinex, which is a pretty solid indicator on certain like longer term timeframes. You're seeing like, you know, I think yesterday 70,000 Ether was bought versus Bitcoin. So, you know, that stuff looks good. I think that, you know, can ETH BTC go to 0.03, 0.02? I find it hard to believe. I mean, the last time I saw it at 0.02 back in, you know, last cycle, like no one thinks anything's going to happen on ETH. So I think it's bad, but it's not that bad. I also think Solana, I'm not as bullish on Solana breaking out like super hard as I think a lot of people are. I think that if you look at fees now on chain, it's like more similar to November 2023 and you're getting that competition that's going to come in, right? You're going to have that. I mean, Justin Sun with Tron is bringing that in with like, you know, meme coin ecosystem. And so I think that if you get a slowdown in Solana, then you're going to have less rotational flows out. I think you just had that vortex effect where, you know, people who own Ether didn't have enough Bitcoin, didn't have enough Sol, and then ETF was over front run. So that was like the, and then Vitalik is dumping on them every day. And then that's like that combination of things.
What about the tech case for ETH? So like, I get the investment case for ETH. ETH is the only other crypto asset other than Bitcoin to have an ETF, which means that if people in the mainstream investment world want to get into crypto, they're going to put some money into Bitcoin and inevitably they're going to put some money into ETH because they don't really have any other options. And I guess we can say for the foreseeable future, 12 to 18 months, there's not going to be a third ETF, regardless of what the third ETF is.
That's right.
So ETH has an investment case. You kind of want to say that even if ETH is not the best asset in the whole world, just the tide of the mainstream investors could keep it a little bit up. But from a tech point of view, like, you know, we've had a little bit more time now to talk about the layer twos and the layer two mishmash that lives on top of ETH. I mean, it is. It's a mishmash of Arbitrum, Optimism, ZK Sync, ZK Sync, Starknet, you name it. How are you feeling about it technologically? Now you've seen Solana play out. We've seen the bull case for Solana, which was the explosion of meme coins. We've seen what the chain can and can't handle at this stage of the game with one validator client. What do you like? How do you see the tech case for ETH long term? Are you still bullish on the ETH tech and the ETH ecosystem long term?
I think it's quite bearish on a number of fronts. I think but it can change. But I think it's I think what you've seen this cycle is like because of this EVM multiple, you know, 100 L2 ecosystem. What you end up with is like applications that they just fork 8 times to get all the grants, and it's like grant farming basically. And then you get, you know, like each EVM chain, they're running the same TVL games, but then there's no innovation at all. And so I think that the cost of that low innovation is kind of coming to roost, right? Where, you know, when you have that kind of ecosystem, you end up with like builders who aren't really building for users. They're more building for kind of, you know, alignment, which then hopefully they get like liquidity on the coin, but like, you know, there's absolutely no point. Like there's no use case. And that I think has really proliferated because, you know, people saw how easy it was with the first wave of these. And then they thought like, okay, we can do it again, keep doing it again. And then, you know, that's why there's that meme, like, you know, just one more L2, bro, just one more. And then we're going to make it, you know, it's like,
so if it's, you actually, were, it's actually, if you were holding ETH, like if you were holding ETH at the moment, I'm assuming that somewhere in your portfolio, you've got some kind of exposure to ETH. What do you do right now? Do you dump your ETH and go into a longer, under the assumption that you're an investor, not a trader, you're not looking for the short-term trade. You're buying this for the 2 to 3 year time horizon minimum. What do you do? Do you hold ETH until, let's just say 2 years? I'm going to call it end of the cycle. We're going to talk about the cycle in a few minutes. But do you hold your ETH? Do you rotate your ETH now? And if you do rotate them, do you rotate them into like another L1? Do you rotate them into Bitcoin? What would be your play? Or would you just go say, this is probably the time to double up on ETH? So I'm keen to understand, on a 2 to 3 year time horizon, how do you position your chips?
I think now is definitely time to double up on it if you have the powder, because I think that it's hard to get much worse than the current sentiment. And you are seeing flows wise, like Bitcoin. I mean, the ETH bottom in 2019 was really bought by Bitcoin whales. It wasn't bought by either people because they ran out of money by then. I think you're seeing something similar that's likely to happen here, where, you know, ETH is not perfect, but neither is Bitcoin, neither is Solana. And I think it is an interesting part of the trade-off cycle. I think one of the things that's very compelling now is you're seeing big crypto punks volume the last 2 weeks. You saw punks go 40% off the floor in like, you know, 2 days, and pretty high volume now on non-floor punks as well, what we call like aesthetic punks, right? Like in the mid-range. And that's usually hyper bullish because it means that people care about, like, if ETH goes to zero, no one cares about signaling that you're early in ETH. It's kind of embarrassing to signal. So I think it's something where, you know, it is, there are some signs of confidence coming back in, despite like, you know, low prices on the ratios. I think there are signs that there is that ETH nationalism that can come back. I mean, really, the price goes above 3K, you know, ETHBTC reclaims 0.05 and everything looks great. So it's like, price leads narrative. I think it doesn't take that much of a move higher after so much has been liquidated basically 3 times now, right? You kind of had these like 3 wicks down, first to 2100, then another like 2500, and then like, you know, over the last few days, like a 2400 retest. So it's been really like it's been knifed 3 times. And you see Vitalik, he's really bull posting it every day now. I think he's under that pressure to do something, not have it go lower, to do something. So I think at the very least, he's not going to dump more. I think Ethereum Foundation is not dumping anymore. I think that's like guaranteed. And so
let me ask you a question. Under the assumption that blockchain started today, and when I say blockchain, not Bitcoin, I mean blockchain as in every other project started today. And we were in a world where Ethereum launched, Solana launched, Aptos launched, Sui launched, Tron launched. Then would there be any case for actually buying ETH? Like, I'm interested to know whether...
No, none.
Which means that the only reason why you would be buying ETH right now is because of legacy. And when you say legacy, you're talking about TVL and ecosystem and tooling that is actually built on ETH, right?
Yes, it's like a JavaScript argument, right? It's like if like, you know, all the languages are released on the same day, like obviously the newer ones you would use before the older ones, but... you know, tooling does matter. And also, I think there's like a safety aspect that does matter. If you look at DeFi, ETH is still very dominant because of that effect. You know,
but is there any reason? Don't. Is there any reason why it should be, other than the fact that there's legacy? So in other words, like, you know, other than the fact that there's legacy, but I mean, and we're not too far down. Like, the reason why I say that is we're not too far down in terms of adoption for the network to jump from one network effect to the other. Like, we're not far down like SMTP or TCP/IP. We're like in the beginning of the race. We haven't even got any kind of mainstream adoption. And I'm kind of questioning, and the reason why I'm questioning is I'm kind of going, why do I actually hold ETH other than the retail narrative that ETH one day may actually pump because it's the second biggest asset? From a technological point of view, I can't justify holding my ETH bag anymore. So I sit down with my investment guys and they're like, why are we still holding this ETH thing? Doesn't move. The technology is shit. Yes, it's got legacy, but there's no real mainstream adoption. And yes, you can argue that things have been built there, but those same experiments have actually been moved to Solana. And one of them actually brought up something very interesting today. He said, go look at Drift on Solana versus Poly Markets, which is on an ETH derivative, so to speak. Drift on Solana, yes, in the last 24 hours, done as much volume or even more volume than Poly Markets. Now you ask yourself a question, like, what can't we actually replicate credibly on? And I'm using Solana like as the default alternative to ETH, but it can be any one of these of the L1s.
Yes.
So I don't know. Like, for me, when I look at the 2-year time horizon, I think I'm emotionally attached to ETH. Emotionally attached to ETH because I was here since the beginning.
I think though that it's not so simple as just pure tech, right? I mean, by that logic, you know, even Bitcoin itself has a lot of problems. I think what you have to think about is like Bitcoin and then Ethereum. It's trying to, you know, you're trying to be able to validate nodes on a Raspberry Pi. You're trying to be able to have that home staking stuff, and so I think that's one aspect of it. And then the second is that like it's sufficiently decentralized, you know, can have ETFs. I think that is something where, you know, people do denominate in Bitcoin. They don't really denominate it either, despite people trying to. There's still some ETH maxes who do that, but it's not as much. But then outside of those, no one denominates in anything else. So like that's something that is also like a base effect. So I definitely agree on the tech side. I think that, you know, like a big mistake that was made, I think, in Ethereum last cycle was like the overhyping of the merge, because the merge is something that was like, you know, now they're starting to say to TradFi, we have cash flows now. Please value us based on the burn. And then they come in like 2 years later and they say, we're going to make the burn zero now. And then so you like basically pump and dumped it essentially, because you told everyone the burn's going to be huge, and then you like lowered the fee, you know, you made it impossible for it to burn anything. So that I think was a grave narrative mistake. I think it's got to tell a different narrative. It's got to tell a narrative that this is like very decentralized. This is like cypherpunk. You know, we don't have like, you know, this is like the highest economic security, right? I think that story has been told properly, but I think if that's told well, you know, that is a major advantage that it has over Solana. I mean, Solana, all the validators are docs. These are known people, right? You can get them all on a Zoom call. So, but that's an argument that only in like a force majeure situation actually matters. And it matters a lot when we're talking about very big amounts of money. But, you know, like for instance, like Sui, like, you know, it's great tech, but, you know, again, you can name every validator. You can name where they are. It's not like you can run Google Sheets also.
So let's move away from the ETH discussion. And let's say if we weren't investing in ETH, you said you were not that bullish on Solana having the major breakout. So let's maybe just go back to say, look, who do you think wins the monolithic L1? Who do you think looks like they could be the leading monolithic L1? Let's assume that ETH's not the monolithic L1. Who's the leading monolithic L1?
I think you will have fragmentation of that monolithic L1 narrative. I think there are a lot of chains kind of gearing up to make a play. You know, Phantom is one of them. I think that there's another. I mean, Sui is another. Aptos is another. And I think that, you know, these are well-funded projects. AVAX as well. I mean, there's well-funded projects now that, like, you know, they've seen the meme playbook. They've seen roughly, you know, like what we saw last cycle was, you know, I think ETH proved the market. They proved the DeFi. And then, you know, the fees got too high. And also people just got saturated. Then it goes to like BSC, then it goes to Phantom, then it goes to AVAX, and it goes kind of all the way down the line. And I think that, you know, Justin Sun doing Sun Pump, I think is something that, you know, some cynics are like, okay, well, that's like can't work. It's going to be Solana. But if you think about it, like this can work on any chain. It's not unique to Solana, not unique to Pump Fun. And I think that, you know, you've seen like early days, it's already like fees are higher. I think it's all about timing, right? It's like, I remember when Andre Crone told everyone, like, you know, why don't we just do all this DeFi stuff on BSC instead of on ETH? And everyone got really mad. And then BNB went from like 40 to 400 in like 2 months. Like, I kind of get those vibes now. I mean, we'll see if I'm right in 3 months, but like, I kind of get those vibes now from like, you know, more aggressive chains that are doing this kind of stuff.
Well, let's spend maybe 2 minutes just talking about Trun and the recent revival. So, I mean, you can love him or hate him, and you can love Tron or hate Tron, but ultimately Tron is one of the only blockchains that on a price point of view, not even a market cap point of view, on a price point of view, is near its 2021 it is near its all-time highs. Does have a lot of daily active addresses. You can't argue the adoption of Tron. You know, the adoption of Tron came from stablecoin transfers, mainly, primarily. $60 billion of the stablecoin market actually lives on Tron, which is liquidity on a chain. Like it or not, there's $60 billion worth of liquidity on Tron. Is it possible that maybe we've overlooked Tron? Because it does have huge adoption. It does have huge liquidity. It's fast enough. It's fast enough and cheap enough. And the only issue is that the only issue is that the criticism that the haters can give you is that it's maybe too centralized.
Yeah. And I think that if you think about centralization, I don't think it's particularly worse versus Solana. So I think that, you know, Tron is really interesting in my opinion, because, you know, the fees are actually massive on Tron just from all the stablecoin usage and transfers. I mean, like in emerging markets, there's massive usage of Tron USDT. Like, ironically, like I think the Tron fees are now higher than the Ethereum fees for like sending USDT, like even per transaction basis, just because of how low ETH gas has fallen, which, you know, usually it's the opposite. But I think Tron is like, it's a completely orthogonal market to the other markets. And I also think that it's just an example of like, you know, if they make a big meme coin push and they make a big, like, you know, if they activate that capital to look at it, like that's, again, it's almost like an ordinal style event, right? Where like ordinals kind of saw what happened in like ETH NFT, and they saw what happened in like, and they said, you know, we can do the same thing. Like, we have lots of money on our chain. Like, and so that's what it reminds me of a bit. And that's why I also think, like, if you look at, like, a lot of influencers moved from, like, Solana to Tron, like, the second day that Justin announced it. And people are like, how dare you? We have, like, Solana nationalism. And then I'm sitting there thinking, people just want to make money. There is no Solana nationalism. They're like, if coins are going to pump, if coins are going to pump, they're going to go, right? And so I think that especially for like meme coin activity, I think it's actually has nothing to do with tooling. Like, this is the thing, like Tron tooling is not great, right? It's kind of stuck maybe 2-3 years ago, but I think it can improve it. And also I think if you think about it, one of the major issues in 2019, 2020 with like Tron, EOS, all this stuff is that they were not good at attracting builders, whereas Ethereum was. You know, it was seen as too centralized ecosystem. Whereas now I think the playbook of like meme coin launchpad, this kind of stuff, is actually totally fine to be centralized, right? Like, it doesn't, like, you don't need really innovative builders on your chain to launch meme coin. Like, that's not a real thing. The only thing you need is BD. It's like BD as a service, and then you need like mindshare and you need pumps. If you create those things, then it's gonna work. So that's why I don't see like unless Solana Foundation is the one pumping like their own meme coins, like I don't actually see a argument for like high market share of like one monolithic chain on meme coins. Like, I think it proves the market, and then I think that these capital flows can be very fast away. So
okay, I agree with you, and I think that a lot of the market, we're putting a lot of this discussion onto meme coins, and I want to spend some time talking about meme coins. Why? Because I think the meme coin market or the meme coin cycle is dead. And I'll tell you why I think the meme coin cycle is dead. I think because we have limited attention in crypto. And when I say limited attention, I call attention humans or people times money that they have. And we have a limited number of attention. And the problem is that too many coins are launching. And when there were few coins, yes, the probability of you making money was actually skewed slightly more in your favor. Now the problem is the probability of you making money is pretty much close to zero. There's 100,000 coins launching every week, every day, whatever it is. There's not even 100,000 people probably even trading them, or I don't know what the exact numbers are, but I think you get what I'm trying to say here. And so I think Pump.fun and SunPump and Four and all these services actually, by making it so easy for people to launch meme coins, killed the market because they ruined the meme coin game. And the only fun that you can actually have is actually not in meme coins, but in influencer coins. And when I say influencer coins, can you work out which of the coins the cabal are behind? And can you get in early enough so that the cabal can dump on you on the way up, but you can still make money? That's how I see the meme coin game at the moment, right? Like, I don't think that the meme coins can succeed without the influencers, the cabal. And I think that the probability of a meme coin organically going from Pump.fun organically without influencers or SunPump and going to a $5 billion market or $1 billion market is close to zero. I mean, it's mathematically.
I absolutely agree. I think that you've seen that big vibe shift with Nero, right? Like, Nero was just insane where as soon as like she tweeted about the new dog name, you've got like tons of contracts launching, like tons of new tokens launching, and they're like fighting over which is the real one. And then on ETH, you have like a Cabal one, which is like super bundled, and that one just pops anyway. And then they get the exchange listings because they can pay for them. And then you kind of see this thing where, yeah, people, they just respect the pump. Like, the narrative before was that the meme coins are like, you know, fair, the coins of the people. And then Nero is funny is because like the one that's bundled the hardest pumps the hardest. And like people are like, well, that's the best one because that's like the cabal owns it. So that one's going to go up. And so, yeah, there's this very rapid like shift now to like the VC coins again. People are saying, well, you know, VC coins are great because the VCs will at least try to pump them when the market's good. Whereas meme coins, they're rugging them every 3 hours. So I think, yeah, you're seeing that full spectrum like shift back. I think that there's also, like you mentioned, like there's a low effort nature now to the idea of meme coins. Like, I think, you know, it's always like, you know, good times create bad men and then bad men create hard times. I think that's where we are in the meme coin cycle where, you know, eventually no one's going to buy anything. And then it's going to be like, okay, let's like create actual culture. Let's create stuff that actually is interesting. Then you're going to get a new cycle of like Mogs and Popcats. But right now it's very hard for these to come out. Cause even if a great idea came, like the cabal will just launch the same version again, but then like pump it better. And then be like, that's the real one. You know, like there's no providence in this stuff.
Yeah. So I think the way I see it is like the way I see the meme coin cycle now, there's two games that can actually be played if you still want to play meme coins. One is called Follow the Cabal. And that is basically what you got to determine is you got to try and get into all the Telegram groups and all the inner circle groups and just try and get in at a low enough market cap and follow the cabal. It's a cool game and it's a fun game, but you need to know the rules. And the rules are that the cabal is going to dump their coins on you on the way up. And you just hope that they're going to do it responsibly so they don't ruin their credibility so that they can keep repeating the same playbook. That is game number one. Game number two is taking old meme coins that have share of market and share of mind, you know, that were launched before Pump.fun era of everything being launched, and reviving those coins because they exist and they do have share of voice and share of mind and community, and those will carry on going up. But I think that's the only two games that can be played in meme coins now. I think all the other games are pretty much dead, like in my opinion. And I think we're probably waiting for the next game. And I think for me, the next game is a combination of prediction markets and culture. And I don't know how that plays out. It's just, I see that meme coins were about attention economy and prediction markets are about predicting where attention is going to land up. And so somehow I think that the two of them merge and we start getting emerge into a prediction of attention markets. And that is, for me, probably what meme coin 2.0 looks like. I'm not sure if you have a view on that.
I mean, I actually think prediction market is a little bit overhyped. I mean, I think if you look at Polymarket, like there's no fees. And also they're incentivizing bid-ask spread on a bunch of stuff. So like post-election, I don't actually think prediction market is going to be that big. Like, I don't think, because there's structural economic problems with prediction markets, right? Like one is adverse selection. Like you don't, like someone knows more than you do on most of the questions. So in general, the edge is negative to trade. And so in the long run, no one trades prediction markets because they don't like to bet on things that they're likely, there's insiders that know the answer, right? And so that's a major problem. And then a second major problem is that the oracles, you know, I was shocked by the RFK Jr. One, which had $10 million bet on it, that he would pull out of the race or not. And that he basically, I mean, it got resolved to that he pulled out, but he's still on the ballot. And he has said on like CNBC that
I'm not pulling out the race.
He pulled out.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, and if you look at the oracles on Polymarket, there's like, you know, I tweeted about this, but it's like 80% of oracles is like the top 10 addresses. So it's like, it's kind of like this thing where it sounds very cool, but then if you really dig into like further and further, you're like, wait a second, this is like actually kind of a sham. So
is that not V1? Like V1 is bad oracles and V2 fixes the bad oracle problem. You know, like it's like sports betting. It's like sports betting. In the old days, the oracle was the biggest problem to sports betting. And then they ended up fixing the oracles, and then sports betting became a big industry, right? Because the oracle problem was fixed. So I think prediction markets are pretty much like sports betting, are really like decentralized sports betting. Who's going to win? You know, who's going to win? Who's going to lose? And then, you know, with sports betting, I guess if you just choose your oracle half correctly, then you've got yourself a reasonable result.
I think the problem though is that prediction markets are not like convex returns, right? Like you're really talking about, you know, making 3x typically or making 5x. I mean, sure, you can buy something at 1% and it goes 100%, but normally we're talking about buying things at 50% and then them going 100. And so there's a sense where, okay, it's really like linear returns and information finding. I don't think it has the same kind of TAM as like shit coins, altcoins, meme coins kind of stuff. I think it's also something where, you know, there's, I mean, to its credit, what it's really good at is getting mainstream to look at it. Like that's the real marketing juice behind prediction markets, is that you can get every mainstream media to cover the odds that site is showing, whether or not like that number is, you know, tons of people trading it or not, like that now becomes like really useful for people to look at. But I think that prediction market is not really like, let's zoom out, right? Like sports betting works because people find entertainment value in that betting. And so even though they're bad at betting on it, they watch the game and then they also bet on it. So the only two things that have so far proven that to be true is like politics and sports.
Why doesn't this replace sports betting? Why don't I just put my bet on prediction markets on Lando Norris winning the Grand Prix versus going to sportsbet.com or I don't know what the betting sites are and placing my bet there? Why?
I mean, you definitely could, but I think that now you're talking about a market which is like, it's already been optimized for UI UX for users by, you know, huge online gaming companies. And so is this a product that is 10 times better? It's the same product, really, I think. Yeah, it's pretty much the same product. And then you got firms spending $1 million a day on ads trying to get those clients. So I think it's, you know, it's not innovation in any real way, in my opinion. I think it is innovation to have, like, you know, to be able to spin up prediction markets on, like, absolutely anything that happens in the world. That is innovation. I just don't think people are actually going to bet that much on those things. I just think it's, you know, like, Intrade was around many years before all this. And I used to trade a lot on Intrade. I bet on Obama. You know, it's something where at the end of the day, there were only two markets that were liquid, even though they tried like almost everything. And that was one, the presidential election. And two is they had these like Dow Jones options. They're like these daily options. And then you trade those as well.
I remember that actually, funny enough. Yeah. So, okay. So. I hear you. You mentioned something earlier. Now, this is something I really want to speak to you about. We'll use the next couple of minutes just to talk about it. Let's think about it like this. You mentioned the VC coins and that they may have a huge pump, so to speak, right? Because the VCs want to support them. I have a theory, and I've been looking for someone to bounce this theory off. So my theory goes as follows. The reason why we all like Bitcoin and the reason why we all like ETH and the reason why we all like Solana is because the price of Bitcoin, ETH, and Solana started low. And so all of us were on the journey and we all ended up making money. We bought our first Bitcoin at $500. it became 1,000. We love Bitcoin a lot. At 2,000, we loved Bitcoin a lot. At 4,000, we were madly in love with Bitcoin. At 8,000, we were over the moon. And by 12,000, we were Bitcoin. We were like, and then ETH came along and we bought it at $2, $4, $6, $8. And because we were part of the journey, we fell in love with the token. And also we were less forced to take profits or to trade out of the token, right? So the first part of my theory says that if you want a token to succeed, the token has to launch at a low price, or it has to be fundamentally unfucking believable. And fundamentally unfucking believable is open to interpretation. But the tokens that succeed the most, Dogecoin, Solana, Bitcoin, Ethereum, those tokens all started low and we were all in there for the ride and we made money, and that's why people like them and they have good community and therefore good coverage and whatever else. The new tokens that come onto the market are at a huge disadvantage. So Aptos comes onto the market, the VCs have bid this thing up to billions and billions of dollars. Same thing with Wormhole, same thing with Starknet, same thing with ZK Sync. The only people that are actually incentivized or care about those tokens are the VCs. And the VCs naturally want to at some point start exiting. So the VCs come in, bought these things up off market, bought them to the market at $2, $3, $4, $10 billion valuations. There's no community investment. No one really gives a shit about Aptos. No one gives a shit about ZK Sync. No one gives a shit about Starknet. Why? Because no one's ever invested and no one's ever made money in those tokens. So, I mean, first of all, I'd like to hear your thoughts on the first part of my thinking. And then I want to maybe bounce a solution off you to see what you think that solution may be.
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. I think that, you know, what you tended to see in the ICO phase is that you have launching at relatively low valuations and coins are going up a lot. There's a lot of speculation. The community is super active. I think that, you know, I think Kobe wrote about this a few months ago, but he was just looking at like, what is the launch FTV of stuff? But then he also pointed out that if you compare it to the price of like Bitcoin or Ether at the time, it's actually still around similar. Like he says like a billion FTV launch versus like a 30 million raise, let's say in 2017 or 16, like it's actually like comparable, which I thought is an interesting argument. Like Polkadot, for instance, raised a lot of money at, you know, some valuation, or if you change it to like ETH price now, it's
actually, therefore it's not here anymore. Therefore it's not here anymore. And again, like I think the reason why Bitcoin is here is because Bitcoin started low. Ethereum started at a 30 million valuation. And even after the ICO, you had a lot of opportunities to buy ETH at under $5. I remember it very clearly. Like you could have bought ETH for a long time under $5.
I mean, I think that it is a valid point though, that if you think about like, crypto's not early anymore in that sense. So can you buy anything under like 100 mil nowadays that is like a big team and like doing a lot of stuff? It's hard, right? And so that's just the nature of the fact that it's not early anymore. But I think that I do agree with you that there's a certain cluster of coins that have been really egregious at launching at super high low float FTVs. And those have purposely almost made it impossible for there to be a community because they've treated the whole market as liquidity. It's almost like a SPAC.
Exactly. And therefore nobody cares about them. So I'm going to use some names. So like ZK Sync, Starknet, Wormhole, Aptos, etc. So let's just use those as examples. I don't know anybody that gives a shit about any one of those tokens unless they're an invested VC. And I don't know what I'm looking forward is. I'm saying if the VCs want to dump their tokens, who are they going to sell the tokens to? Because there's no buyers, because no one actually cares, because no one's following these tokens' progress, because no one actually cares about them. But I think I actually have the fix as well. So like, it's not only that I've noticed the problem, but I actually think I have the fix. Here's the fix. The fix is to unlock all the tokens except for the validation tokens. So except for the natural inflation validation tokens, the fix for me is to unlock all the tokens. And let the price collapse. So let an Aptos go down to 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 billion. I don't know what the market caps are. That will create an opportunity for retail to get in very, very early or very low whilst people who want to exit, right? And then you can start the growth curve again, but this time with the right community. So it's almost like reverse engineering by saying, we messed up. In order to make good, we're going to release all the tokens. The price is going to go down. This is your opportunity to buy. And then eventually we're going to actually go up on the road. Now, the downside is that maybe for a couple of months, maybe a year, you're going to have a low token price, which means that you need to fund your foundation, your grants, and whatever else up front. The upside is that you're getting people actually excited about your token because people are naturally going to make money. And as people make money about your token, so you start the investor momentum. And so like I've been scratching my head about how to fix the whole industry. And to me, the minute one of them does this, then everybody follows, right? And the only people that might complain are the VCs.
I think it's complex though, because I think that, I mean, you're assuming that retail or like community is smart enough to buy a coin when it's cheap. They could also just be like, well, the coin is dead now. And so there's a strange way in which, like, I think ecosystem coins, they're now incentivized to be high because they now give points and they give grants to people and they say, here in the future, I give you all this value. And so the usage of token as like doing partnerships necessitates a higher price relative to what it's fair value. I think SBF kind of invented that game last cycle with like a high FTT price or a high serum price. He can then get everyone to show for them, even though they can't sell their serum. People are like super excited and pumped about it, right? So that's the same kind of game is being played on the ecosystem side. And, you know, that's why it's really important for people to think that Blast is a high FTV. That's what makes you farm it. That's what makes you put the TVL in. And so, you know, it could be that this cycle, like, retail is too dumb to buy like a low price ecosystem coin because they'll just be like, well, this is low TTVL. This is low. You know, I can be early, but what am I early to? I'm early to something that no one cares about. And, you know, there's also this way in which if you have a high price, then the dollar volume is higher. And then there's also this obsession with liquidity, which is also kind of silly because you want to buy coins to make 100x. Why do you care about liquidity, right? And so
hold on a second.
You know, that's why.
Let's play a little game here. Let's just for 2 seconds, humor me. Let's play a little game here. Let's assume that Aptos was the first one to do this. And the reason why I use Aptos is because for me, Aptos is one of those tokens where the tech is good. You can't argue that the tech is good. The guys are smart. The tech is good. The VCs are in there. And I think that there's not a single retail investor that actually cares about Aptos. I may be wrong. There may be one or two, but I think there's very few that do. Right now, their fully diluted market cap is $8 billion. I don't see any good retail investor saying, I'm hungry to buy this $8 billion. Unlock all the tokens. Let's say the valuation goes down to $3 or $4 billion. Okay, just hypothetically. Okay, $3 or $4 billion is where the valuation goes to. Retail sees this. They have a frame of reference called SUI. SUI has a market cap of, I don't know, $9 billion. What's the number? I don't know. Let's quickly look at it. Sorry, it went back to Solana. So let's quickly look at SUI, and here we go. It's got $8.5 billion. So wouldn't retail then say, hold on a second, this is cheap? And then they'd start buying it, and then you'd get a whole new cohort of retail investors that actually really care about the token, right? So like really, really, really care about the token. And then you can start again, and you can create the cult-like movement that is Solana, that is Ethereum, that is Dogecoin, that is Bitcoin. I just don't understand. I just don't see any way that these high FTV tokens create a cult-like movement. And without that, I don't see how you succeed in crypto other than artificially maintaining the price by keeping the VCs in against their will, so to speak. You know, like
yeah. I definitely agree with that. I mean, I don't know if the solution works because I think it has also problems on its own. And it's partially like the reason why we've evolved to this market structure are because of those reasons. Like, because of the fact that if you have a higher FTV, you get more attention, you get faster listings, you get more, and then the team tries to sell secondaries. And if they can sell secondaries successfully, then they can cash out and bro down, right? So I think if you're the team, you're still incentivized to have a high FTV because in the off chance you get to do a loss round with some VC, you now have cash, which you can, you know, have in your thing. So, you know, whereas if the FTV is too low, yeah, you might attract people to buy out the VCs, but you also may just get retail laughing at it. Then they're like, oh, this is like low price. I don't care. I'm going to, you know, because that's something like that. Like the IQs are getting drastically lower each cycle in crypto. I mean, you've seen it. And so now I think we're at a point now where, you know, coins that, you know, some FTV that is like respectable, they feel like it's somehow safer, even though that's not really true, right? I mean, think about Definity. The last cycle, they cashed out $3 billion selling ICP from 500 down to like 10. And people were buying it the whole way down, even though it was like very high FTV the whole way down. And it's something where, why were they doing that? I don't know. But that's something where the high FTV somehow gives it the credibility that it's legit. And so, you know, are people qualified to buy a project early these days? I don't know if that's the case, right? Like if a project launches that way, a lot of people would say, or they're leaving money on the table, they should do it a different way. And if teams are coming in and make money, they will do that. Like, I think one team that is doing it kind of like that is Hyperliquid, right? Where they are coming in and they're saying, I'm not going to have any V-season. And so I'm going to try to have it start low. You get points, you use it, and then it goes up. You know, but even that model remains to be seen because, you know, what will happen when it actually TGEs? Can they attract another community in from that? Like, cults are good, but you also have to expand the cult through economic activity, right? So Ethereum was very early. Fundamentals. And so Ethereum was very early. And so they had no competitors really for at least, you know, like a year and a half. And so it could grow from that experience. And then later competitors all came in and then it lost market share. So now if you do this, like a project, a tech project, ecosystem project, which is like at low FTV, let's say like, you know, a billion or half a billion, you know, you're at this like really dangerous situation where another project can just like raise at a higher FTV and be like, well, I'm going to incentivize all your builders to come to my chain.
You get a bit of a vampire attack.
And your cult is from buyers maybe that bought it cheap, but they also might not have the conviction to buy your coin cheap. They may be like, well, I see way better builders there, way better VCs there. I'm going to go over there. And so people like paying high prices for coins. They love nothing more than pay a very high price for coins. So they don't usually like to pay low prices for coins. And so that's something that's difficult. Like you may have been buying ETH under $10, but not that many people were, right? And so, you know, did ETH grow because it allowed people to buy at $10? Maybe, but I think it's also because it succeeded because it was in a
non-competitive
space.
You got to have success. Okay, so with that, I want to like wrap it up and say, okay, we've spoken about L1s and we've spoken about ETH and we've spoken about potential L1s. If I were to say to you, Sue, listen, I've got $10,000. And I want to allocate it for between now and the end of the cycle. I'm not going to trade in and out. I'm busy with my business life, my work life. How do you allocate the $10,000 across? Let's just for now just say L1s, because I mean we can go one level lower, but the problem is that becomes a bit messy. How would you allocate the $10,000?
I think Sui is probably my bet.
All 10,000, just one chip on the table and spin the wheel, or would you hedge the bet a little bit, but maybe taking some Sol, some Tron?
You can do half Sol, half Tron. I mean, half Sui, half Tron. I think is a good bet. I think that the Sol play is. I mean, you're at a top five coin now. You're at a top three coin now. I think stuff always gets dangerous when you get in this zone because it will be very consensus. And it takes huge amounts of money to move it. And it's like this thing where you have to bet on everything going right. I think Tron has another, I think Tron is good. I think Sui will, you know, I know a lot of Sol builders and they're like, they can deploy the same shit on Sui. And so there's that effect where as that gets going, I think it can be quite interesting.
Okay, so Sui, good bet. What do you think of BSC chain? The chain still has a lot of activity. The price of the BNB token, which is a combination of BSC and the exchange, is actually quite like, I mean, I think holdings, let's say, surprisingly well, given that CZ's been in prison for 4 months. Just because I haven't actually followed it today, but let's just quickly look at the price today. It's $538. I mean, if I would have told you that this was going to be trading at $538 at this stage of the game, you probably would have thought I was crazy. What do you think? Like, is it still a chain, or is this just a play on the exchange?
I think it's more a play on the exchange. I mean, I think obviously the chain has a lot of activity still, but I think we're in general going toward a calmer period in Binance's growth because they've just crushed so hard. Like, they're number one in. I think Binance was a genius at using BNB as this growth vector, as just being like, okay, like the launch pad. You know, you buy a BNB, you get all these crazy deals, and then, you know, that becomes the driver. I think now they don't really need to. So I think that ECO will still exist, but I think the returns of the token are just going to be normal returns. I think it will still outperform 90% of altcoins, but I think it's not, I don't see it as like this, you know, extra, super extra outperformance. I do think that on CZ release, I think you're going to get probably a pump. I mean, it's a consensus view now, but I think he comes back to crypto?
You think like CZ actually comes back to crypto after he's? I mean, this place is
no,
full
I don't
of.
Think, I don't think he comes back in the way that people are expecting. But I think he will. Like, I think he won't tweet about crypto that much. But I think he will tweet in general. I think he does aspire to be like a influencer. I mean, not in a bad way, but in terms of like a he wants to be heard.
He wants recognition.
He wants recognition. Yeah. So I think, you know, education stuff he'll talk about, other stuff he'll talk about. But I think that you'll probably get a BNB pump on that kind of like awareness pump. I mean, like even with Telegram, like I'm pretty bullish ton as actually as well. I think, you know, Pavel going in for a bit, I think is actually bullish because it just, I mean, the Telegram app went to like number one app downloaded in like 20 countries as soon as he went in because people was like, who is this? Like, what is this app? Maybe I need it, right? And it's just this weird way that the human brain works.
Unbelievable.
And so, you know, I think that ton is interesting as well from that perspective.
I mean, Ton's got great distribution. Technology-wise, not the best tech in the world, but I mean, distribution-wise, amazing distribution. For me, Ton is a bet on distribution. I agree with you around the Ton thesis. And I actually think, to be honest, that in his calculations, Pavel actually one of his outcomes would have been, if I land up in jail, how do we keep this app alive? I can't believe that he was that surprised to be arrested. I'm sure that he's constantly confronted by legal notices, legal letters, legal requests. And I think that in his head, he must have always been living with anxiety that at some stage, someone's going to catch me and what am I going to do? And I guess the biggest risk for me around Telegram is that for some reason, it gets removed from the app stores. So like founder goes to jail. He is convicted guilty on charges of child porn, whatever else, illicit drug trafficking, money laundering. And then as a result, Apple and Google actually remove the app from the App Store in places like Europe or you know, or something like that. That for me is the risk around Telegram and Ton blockchain. Like, you know, I see the EU putting a lot of pressure on Apple or Google or whoever it is to remove the app from the App Store if he's found guilty. And that for me is the risk.
I think so. I mean, you're already seeing in some countries, like I think in Indonesia, they just talked about banning Telegram from the country. You know, in Korea, there was that like sex ring that used Telegram. And they, you know, they couldn't find out who the users were. I think that pressure is massive. But I think that being said, I think, you know, it's like has a billion users. So I think even if it gets removed, people can just go to the website and download it. Like, I don't think it matters. It's like Fortnite. Like, Fortnite also doesn't need to be downloaded through the App Store. It's big. It's a big brand. So I don't think it's such a big deal.
Maybe you're right. Maybe actually more people will download it because it's not available in the App Store, because it's like this like movement of like, okay, we'll show the authorities. We're going to do this because we're not allowed to do it. Yeah.
All right. Exactly.
Sue, listen, it's been absolutely amazing. I know you're staying behind to speak to some of our front runners on the other links. I want to thank you for, amazing conversation, amazing Elf. It's very rare that I can speak to someone and have such cool discussions about all things crypto and all things tokenomics and stuff like that. So thank you so much. To you guys, the Banter fam, of course, I will see you guys again on Monday with our regular programming. Until then, trade well, my friends.